It's Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear about a proposal to make Milwaukee's police chief an elected position.
First, the State Department of Corrections has acknowledged it missed the deadline to outfit corrections officers in six Wisconsin prisons with body cameras.
Governor Walker allocated nearly $600,000 in the state budget to purchase the equipment in an effort to address concerns at prisons, namely the safety of both guards and prisoners.
Since the deadline was missed, it could mean that guards won't have the body cameras for some time. Molly Beck is the state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and has the latest on this story. Molly, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So when I think of body cameras, I tend to think more of police officers on patrol using them, not necessarily correctional workers and prison guards. How did we end up with this directive in the first place?
Yeah, so this issue came up a couple years ago, primarily out of the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison troubles that you may have heard of. There's a federal investigation going on there at the youth prison in Irma. And that's partly because there have been allegations of staff abusing inmates there. So one of the remedies that the Department of Corrections put in place was to have the correctional officers wear body cameras. So when there are these interactions with the inmates that become violent for whatever reason, they have a recording of why it became violent, what they did, and then it's less of a he said, she said situation afterward. So last year in the budget process, Governor Walker recommended a pilot program of sorts in the adult prison system for the same reasons, because there was about a 19% increase in staff assaults and in the adult prison. So he put some money in the budget for 200 body cameras for correctional officers at six maximum security prisons.
So you mentioned that Governor Walker put this money into the budget, but was this something that both parties here in Wisconsin were pushing for?
I don't know if anybody was really out there pushing for it, but it was just kind of an issue that the legislature has been talking about because of the Lincoln Hills issues. There's clearly an issue with staff in these prisons being assaulted from the lawmakers' perspective, and they want to make sure these prisons are safe, and they think that this is one way to identify what problems, if any, are there that maybe the legislature could address.
So all of this brought us to July 1st. There was a deadline there. It came. It went. What happened?
So the budget told DOC to get these in place immediately and to present a report to lawmakers about how many assaults occurred since the body cameras had been put on the correctional officers and other data, and DOC informed the lawmakers that were supposed to receive the report that they don't have them yet. They apparently purchased them in April, or have a contract to purchase them in April, and they haven't received them yet.
So we have no other information other than they just haven't received them yet.
Right. They said that there was a lengthy procurement process and that they had a decision-making process that took a long time to figure out which features they wanted on the cameras. So it's hard to say exactly which took longer and why the legislature wasn't notified before June 2nd, but that is the reasoning that they're giving.
So I know that state Democrats have kind of been pouncing on the Department of Corrections for various things over recent years, whether it be staffing, whether it be security. Is this something that they are also pouncing on right now?
Oh, yeah. I think the Senate Minority Leader, Jennifer Schilling of La Crosse, and Senator LaTanya Johnson of Milwaukee, both Democrats, they think this is just another example of Governor Walker's record in corrections that they characterize as being very poor. Even though Governor Walker did, ask for this money to be put in the budget, they're blaming this on him.
We're talking right now with Molly Beck. She is the state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's with us to talk about the State Department of Corrections missing the deadline to equip corrections officers in six state prisons with body cameras. And Molly, what has the reaction been from Governor Walker? Has he commented on this?
The only thing Governor Walker's office has said is that he supports correctional officers wearing body cameras. His spokeswoman did not address what he thought about the delay. It sounds like some of these prisons won't have the body cameras in place until the end of next year, which is almost 2 years after, the funding was authorized to have them. Democrats are going to you know, continue to criticize Governor Walker because of this. He does oversee, you know, all the state agencies, obviously, and his record on corrections is something that they've made, you know, a focal point of this his upcoming re-election bid. So I think we'll hear more about this.
Yeah, I'm wondering how you see corrections factoring into this November election. There's been a lot of back and forth in recent years about Lincoln Hills, about the best way to proceed with possibly building a new prison and working with the ones that we already have. I mean, how big of an issue do you think corrections is going to be as we head into a primary here in August and then the general as well in November?
I think it will be a side issue. I'm not sure people get really fired up about corrections issues at the polling places. Otherwise, I think we'd hear about it more. But I do think Democrats are going to be talking about the Lincoln Hills issue because it's been going on so long, and they can point to, you know, a moment in time in 2012 that Governor Walker was notified of unsafe conditions there, and nothing really happened until 2015. And then by that point, a lot was happening, and there were federal investigators involved and everything. So I think the Lincoln Hills issue will be something that you might see in an ad. There was a guard at Lincoln Hills that was beaten up pretty severely, and she's been pretty vocal about her criticism of Governor Walker because of that situation. I'm just speculating that might be something, or something similar might be in some sort of ad. I know that the current Democratic frontrunner, Tony Evers, has talked a lot about Lincoln Hills. He just put out a digital advertisement with the former DOC secretary blaming Governor Walker for the problems at Lincoln Hills. So I do think that will be an issue that you'll hear about. You might also hear, we had a story in today's paper by my colleague Patrick Marley about Democrats' ideas for cutting the prison population if they were elected in November. So I think both of those issues will be something that you might hear as a side issue this fall.
I'm also wondering, this is probably one of the first times that I can recall hearing Department of Secretary Kathy Jess's name in the news since she took over the job of secretary a few months back. It seems like she was kind of brought in sort of to, I don't want to say clean up some of the messes, but, you know, she was acquiring a lot of things from her predecessor. But do you get a sense from who you've talked to how things are going for her so far and how people are reacting to her tenure?
I haven't heard much from lawmakers of either side about her. She was in the DOC administration all along, and it might be a function of the fact the legislature's not in. I haven't heard much about her, but that also means I haven't heard any criticism either, and I think if there was something there, the Democrats would have said something about it. So this is the first time that I've seen her name attached to something that we've written about.
So going back to the body cameras for a minute, is the next step here just to kind of wait and see when the department gets them, or are there other steps or hurdles along the way that we should be watching for?
The Department of Corrections has said that they are working as fast as they can, and they plan to get some in place by the end of this year. So that's something that people like me and other reporters, and also I'm sure lawmakers, will be watching for. It didn't sound like lawmakers who oversee the budget committee, which is where the report was supposed to go, that DOC missed filing, or Governor Walker. At least they didn't indicate to me that they were very, very concerned about this missed deadline and would be taking steps to ensure that, you know, the later this year deadline would be met. So I think it'll come down to probably reporters just following this issue.
And I'm also curious, too, if you're an employee of the Department of Corrections, you're potentially worried about safety, you're potentially worried about, other things at your job. And meanwhile, you've got the Department of Corrections saying, like, we'll get these body cameras to you when we can. Do you get a sense that maybe there's, for employees, there's a general sense of unhappiness or even, I don't know, distrust out there?
I know that there have been a number of staff within DOC at various prisons, and I obviously have not heard from everybody or even a majority, but I have heard from some that say that they don't feel safe. Lincoln Hills is a good example of that. There are many staff there who have been accused of treating inmates poorly, but they've come back and said, well, some of this stuff is because we're short-staffed and we're working 16-hour days, mandatory because we are short-staffed. And, you know, because of this federal scrutiny, you know, we're afraid to really manage behavior the way we think we should, you know, and so in that way they feel unsafe there. And in other institutions with crowding issues, I've heard from correctional officers who say they also feel unsafe. Not as highly concentrated as the Lincoln Hills issue, but that could be just a function of we are covering the Lincoln Hills issue a little bit more. So, yeah, I have heard concerns. I'm not sure if they are, you know, systemic or just there's pockets of it, but that is something that we're looking at.
Molly, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Molly Beck is the state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us to talk about the State Department of Corrections missing its deadline to outfit corrections officers with body cameras in six Wisconsin prisons.
A proposal floated to Milwaukee's Common Council earlier this week has sparked a conversation about how the city hires its police chief.
A resolution from one Milwaukee alderman is looking to make the position elected, letting city voters pick their chief as opposed to a chief being appointed.
But the idea is getting some real pushback, coming from some other council members, Mayor Tom Barrett, and at least one state lawmaker.
Alderman Khalif Rainey represents Milwaukee's 7th District, which includes the Lincoln Creek and Sherman Park neighborhoods, among others. And he's with us now to talk about the plan. Alderman Rainey, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So where did this idea come from, and why did you want to pursue this?
Well, I mean, ultimately, here in the city of Milwaukee, we have issues between the community and the police. And I think allowing the community to have a greater voice in this conversation by allowing the police chief to become elected, it could potentially change outcomes. I myself, who is an elected official, I go door to door, talk to constituents, get an understanding of what it is they would like to see here in the city of Milwaukee. Ultimately, through the campaign process, the process itself is what shapes outcomes. So I think if a police chief had to actually be accountable to the residents of the city of Milwaukee in a greater way, I think that very well could shape and make a difference in how policing is conducted here in the city of Milwaukee.
So right now, the police chief is appointed by the Fire and Police Commission. Has that commission not done enough in your eyes to hold a police chief, whoever it might be, accountable?
Well, for me personally, I'm just, you know, kind of astonished at the idea that, you know, there's a body that's considered to be, you know, wiser than the electorate themselves. You know, this is an electorate that, you know, sent me down. They had the wisdom to send myself and, you know, 14 other members of the common council along with the mayor. Why do they not have the ability to have discernment and make a decision about who is the chief of police in their community? I just really don't understand the concept.
So I want to talk about some of the pushback that you've gotten to this idea. We will hear from Alderman Mark Borkowski. He criticized the plan, pointing to Milwaukee County's former Sheriff David Clark. Here's what he had to say.
We've just gone through 8 or 10 years of an elected sheriff, and it was an absolute disaster. We had a demagogue out of control and then not doing his job, and he was elected, and nobody could hold him accountable to anything.
On a similar note, Mayor Tom Barrett has said, should we really have a politician running the police department? What do you make of these points, and is it sort of dangerous to get politics involved in this?
You know, first and foremost, when you're discussing the county sheriff, this is Milwaukee County, which is comprised of 19 municipalities. Milwaukee County is not only the city of Milwaukee, but it's also Hell's Corners, Cudahy, South Milwaukee, Greenfield, Glendale. These are communities that have different political ideologies than the city of Milwaukee. The city of Milwaukee being a city that has elected a Democratic mayor nearly its entire existence. So to say that a personality such as Sheriff Clark could be elected, you know, I think that that's insulting to the, you know, people of the city of Milwaukee. I think that they would see through that. And when you talk about, you know, politicizing the process in which a police chief is, you know, ascends to that level, I mean, right now, city of Milwaukee aldermen have a great deal of ability, you know, as it relates to licenses, real estate, you know, the mayor has a great deal of ability. All of these elected positions hold major influence. So to think that, you know, one is greater than the other, or to imagine that elected officials themselves actually advocating against democracy or elected office, again, I'm baffled.
We're talking right now with Alderman Khalif Rainey. He represents Milwaukee's 7th District, and we are talking about his proposal to how the city selects a police chief. And I'm also wondering, Representative Alderman Rainey, some might look at this proposal and say, well, maybe you're just dissatisfied with the current police chief, Alfonso Morales. Is that it?
Not at all. I mean, this is not about personality. This is about process. You know, what I'm trying to do is give a greater voice to the people of this city. What I would like to see is the people of the city of Milwaukee actually affecting change in how policing is conducted in their community. Again, if a police chief had to get out here on the south side and talk to Mr. Martinez, if he had to get out here and talk to Ms. Stankowski, talk to Ms. Jackson, that would make a great deal of influence on how he polices as an elected official. He would have to take those things into consideration if he wanted to continue to be the chief of police in the city of Milwaukee. I think it's something that should be given some consideration. Ultimately, at the end of the day, what should be considered is how can we increase the participation of our city residents in this process. In Baltimore, they've examined different ways to widen that ability to give the community a greater voice. If you look at the process in which Morales became chief, there are some people who took exception as it related to public meeting notice. You know, so there's issues with the process. And again, why should there be someone more wiser than the electorate to select the police chief? It's the same people who elect me, elect the mayor. And lastly, I think with a issue like this on the ballot, it could actually draw one of the largest participations in the election ever here in the city of Milwaukee.
Do you think that candidates, let's say that this proposal went through, do you think we would see candidates running for the city's police chief that maybe they're individuals that wouldn't be considered for an appointment otherwise?
Possibly. You know, ultimately, one way that we can kind of tailor the candidates who are actually qualified to run is codifying some of that education, some of that experience required. So, you know, there's ways the city can address this matter systematically and make sure that it still brings forth candidates who have great value. But again, ultimately, it's something that we should give a greater eye to.
One other concern that I wanted just to bring up is whatever race that we're talking about, whether it be for state assembly, state senate, Congress, people are going to worry about money and outside influence coming into a race. Is that something that you're thinking about as well with this proposal?
I mean, money's not involved in campaigns. That's the electoral process that's established not just here in Milwaukee, but this country. It's my belief. I have confidence in the electorate. I have the belief that they will be able to have a discernment and still determine, despite how much money was spent, that who's the quality that's good for them and their community, especially on a topic such as the police chief. I think that when people have the ability to actually come out and have a conversation about their experiences and what they've gone through and what they would like to see done in their community, I think the person who actually runs for that office will have to be someone who is really willing to dig in and do that. I think if you weren't prepared to do that, those type of candidates wouldn't even run.
So talk more about how you plan on going forward with this and what else you're planning on talking to your fellow aldermen, trying to get the city on board. How are you going about trying to gain support for this proposal?
Well, I think that, you know, the conversation alone has produced some good discussion. For example, Alderman Bauman said that, you know, it should be another role, another opportunity played by appointment and accountability to the common council. You know, again, this is simply just a directive to our lobbyists to go to the state of Wisconsin and to have this conversation with them to consider this type of policy. I just want to have a conversation. Right now we had an incident with Sterling Brown. We had the uprising in Sherman Park. You know, these are things that as a community we have to get a hold of. We have to figure out how to get better outcomes. So the conversation being had alone, I think, is a win.
And I'm curious, too. I mean, obviously, this issue of whether or not a police chief in Milwaukee should be appointed or elected doesn't exist with a vacuum. Within a vacuum, other people have pointed to the department and said, hey, there are other problems that we need to solve. Do you see this as sort of like a standalone proposal, or are there other reforms that kind of need to go along with this?
I definitely think there are other reforms that should occur in addition to this type of policy. I think there's a lot of things that could be addressed. You know, at this moment, I'm just specifically focused on having this conversation. That's the conversation of having the chief of police elected in the city of Milwaukee.
And should this go forward, it would have to go to the state legislature. What do you think it would take to get the legislature on board with something like this?
Probably, you know, some sessions with the people here in the city of Milwaukee, actually taking time to engage with the residents and understand their perspective. You know, I think if they heard from the residents themselves as to what the value of such a process would be, I think it could be compelling.
And going forward, there's going to be a lot more discussion about this. You're going to be engaging constituents. Have you heard from a lot of constituents that, you know, should they get the chance to vote on it? This is something that they really want to shape, and this is something that they would really like to have a voice in going forward.
You know, interesting enough, one of the things that has, you know, come to light just from the conversation is that I don't believe that citizens truly realize how they were circumvented in this process. You know, the police chief just somewhat just arrives and it's like, oh, we got a new police chief. You know, I think that them now having an understanding, and I received text messages like, wow, that's a good point. You know, I really think that could shape public safety outcomes if we had a greater conversation and he was accountable to the actual residents and not accountable to the mayor or accountable to the police and fire commission. So, yeah, it's something that constituents have responded to.
Well, Alderman Rainey, and we're going to have to jump in because we're just about out of time. Okay. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Wonderful. Appreciate time. Take care.
Yeah, you too. Alderman Khalif Rainey was with us. He represents the 7th District of Milwaukee, and he was with us to talk about his proposal to make the city's police chief an elected position.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the cost of emotional labor in the workforce. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Chris Molina. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Whether you work as a barista or a bus driver, you've probably had to put on emotions that weren't quite genuine. Fabricating a happy face is something that's expected across a wide range of jobs, and those of us who have done it know that the emotional labor involved can be exhausting.
Our next guest researches what happens to people who have to fake their emotions as part of their job and how it impacts their workplace and their well-being.
Alicia Grandy is a professor of industrial organizational psychology at Penn State University. Alicia, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
So let's first define a little more what we mean when we talk about emotional labor in the workplace.
Sure. Emotional labor is, you can think of it akin to physical labor, right? It's a type of work that one has to do, but instead of with their body or their muscles, it's with their emotions, with their expressions towards others. And it's part of their professional work role. To put on a smile or to manage their emotional expressions with others is an expected requirement of the job.
And you've done a lot of research on what happens when we put on that smile and fake those emotions. And it sounds like it has both mental and physical consequences. What are some of those common results that you found?
Yeah, there's a whole set of them. So when people are doing this kind of emotional labor continuously day after day, it really can wear on the body. And that's because there's a sense of dissonance between what they're showing and what they're feeling. So that creates a tension within ourselves. We don't tend to like that feeling. So there's associations with symptoms, like health symptoms, like headaches and stomach aches, with mood, so anxiety and depression. There's associations with not liking your job, dissatisfaction, life dissatisfaction. And I'm actually finding in some of my recent research, there's associations with behaviors at home. So it actually spills over and affects sleep. It affects even drinking behavior, willingness to help out at home.
And why do we know why adopting those emotions for a work shift day after day, week after week, month after month? Do we know why it's so exhausting for a human being to do that?
Yeah, so the dissonance idea is one explanation. So when you're putting on an expression that's different than how you feel inside, it creates a dissonance or an inauthenticity. And we as a society, an American society, we tend to like to show how we're feeling, and acting phony doesn't feel right. It creates a tension inside ourselves, and that's a physical tension. It also is effortful. So this is something that's often considered to be easy labor, right? Just smiling at people sounds easy. It sounds pleasant. It sounds intrinsically motivating. But doing it repeatedly with customer after customer, and even customers who are not being the nicest to you, is part of where that extra effort comes in and makes it really fatiguing.
So it might feel really differently if someone comes up and they're genuinely friendly and they smile at you when you're taking their order, as opposed to, and you smile back and you mm-hmm. have a nice exchange versus the grumpy person. I think I saw an example of the guy that comes in every day for coffee, never tips, and always complains about the coffee being too cold unless he's right. complaining that it's too hot. So we might be making the same small talk, making the same facial expressions with those two different customers, but we react differently to it, don't we?
Sure, yeah, and it is nice to have those positive exchanges, and that's kind of what we expect with our interactions with friends or family. There's a reciprocity there, a back and forth. If I'm nice to you, I expect you're going to be nice back, because we're maintaining an ongoing relationship. But in these service encounters, that's not necessarily the case. You may not interact with the same person repeatedly. You might see that customer coming, and even though you don't like them because they're always complaining, you still have to interact with them. So there's a lack of reciprocity of a fair exchange there compared to personal relationships.
What are some of the jobs we talked about? For instance, baristas, we mentioned bus drivers. I worked as a waitress. There's certainly a lot of mm-hmm. emotional labor there. Are there other jobs or categories of jobs that we might not be thinking about when we think of emotional labor, but where it's a real component?
Yeah, there's actually been work showing that many, many of our jobs today have an interpersonal, strong interpersonal component. It's almost hard to think of jobs that don't require some amount of emotional labor. Even people who are doing physical labor work, like a construction worker, they might have to work with the client. And in doing so, you know, have to maintain kind of that that professionalism in addition to a friendly tone, regardless of their internal state. But some occupations that have been studied include administrative assistants, so receptionists or people who support managerial staff. It's people that include cheerleaders, professional cheerleaders. Their job is obviously to maintain a high level of enthusiasm, to keep the crowd up. They've been studied as a group. Nurses, people in the caring professions. Also, they're both maintaining a professional air, but also trying to calm people who are upset, even if they themselves might be feeling disgusted or fatigued at the time in their work interactions.
We're talking with Alicia Grandy. She's a professor of industrial and organizational psychology at Penn State University, and we're talking about emotional labor, the need to put on a happy face, a happy demeanor as part of your job. Marcia on Facebook wrote, "If I were paid for my emotional labor, I'd be a gazillionaire. Anyone who'd like to spend some time with me while I work with students in a high school where there's quite nearly a majority of students with mental illness, physical illness, IEPs, etc., is welcome to message me to set up a date to see what I mean." That's a whole area that we haven't even touched on, education.
Yes. Yeah. So the work that involves students or patients or kind of work that has to really be caring and compassionate, but also you're dealing with people with real difficulties, whether those are educational or health-related or mental health, as that person mentioned. There's also there a really strong professional norm of you're supposed to want to do it. You're not supposed to want to be paid for it, right? You're supposed to want to be caring and compassionate to those people. And I think that puts an extra burden on those people who then may feel guilty if they're complaining about that emotional labor.
How much does it differ if we are, you know, having to be friendly to our coworkers who we see every day or maybe, you know, work a few shifts with a week versus that one-off with a customer? Is one or the other more tiring?
That's a great question. I don't know if we know the answer to that. We do know that small daily hassles aggregate over time. They can accumulate and create a major health issue, just the same as one major interpersonal event can. So I think it depends on the person. It depends on how much they ruminate over that negative event. It could happen once, but it really is distressing, and it's something they keep thinking about, and then it keeps affecting all their future interactions, even if they're pleasant.
I remember reading when I was preparing for this interview that there are really two different types of how we kind of put on that friendly, happy demeanor. One is very surface level and one is a much deeper level. What's the difference between those two?
Yeah, so they draw on a dramaturgical or a theater-based perspective of a service work. So a person can go out and interact surface level. So that's just putting on the mask. You fake that smile. You just hide and push down how you're really feeling. I mean, that's kind of like a person, an actor getting on stage and just going through the motions. So it's not a great performance, but it gets the job done. On the other hand, you could have an employee who does deep acting, and this would be maybe they're kind of thinking about that customer as a friend. They're trying to understand where they're coming from, take their perspective. If they're upset or, like you said, the person that's always grumpy, they might, you know, think, well, maybe he has health issues or maybe he's lonely. I mean, that helps you find that compassion and change how you're actually feeling. So it's not just putting on a mask. You're actually changing your internal state to be in line with what you're showing. And that improves the performance. It also seems to be less stressful because then you're not experiencing that dissonance, that tension between your feeling and your expression.
We're talking with Alicia Grandy right now. She's an industrial organizational psychologist from Penn State, and we're looking at the effects of emotional labor.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have to fake certain emotions in your job? What impact does that have on you, your well-being? Do you have a method for dealing with that or making these emotions more genuine? And do you think employers should be taking these demands into account more than they do? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
Right now, we're continuing the conversation on emotional labor with Alicia Grandy, professor of industrial organizational psychology at Penn State.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. If emotional labor is part of your job, tell us about your experience. Is it tough on you? Do you have tricks for how to put on emotions that might not be genuine? What do you wish customers or employers knew about your job? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And let's go to the phones, and Pam in Richland Center is up. Hi, Pam.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just thinking this sounds familiar, similar to like compassion fatigue. It's something you hear in the psychology or social work field is just the having to care for so many variety of people. And I know working with that I often see in my kids' management job the need to, like, take more breaks in between people. It's kind of like when you do, like, crisis line work. You're just hit one crisis after another. So, anyway, that's a term that's been used a lot. The social work is compassion fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing I thought of is you were talking about actors or, you know, I was thinking that would be a environmental hazard. But also, like, bartenders, too, like anywhere who, you know, where you're trying to be sympathetic.
That's a great point. Thanks for that, Pam. And Alicia, what about that comparison to compassion fatigue?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I've just now made contact with a nurse manager who's very interested in thinking more about how emotional labor plays a role in the compassion fatigue she's seeing among her nurse team. The idea of breaks is also a great one, so that the effort it takes to maintain that smile over time is effort just like it is doing physical labor, like holding up an object and moving heavy objects repeatedly. You need to take breaks to give that emotion time to settle back down, come back to baseline, find your happy place, find a colleague you can kind of be yourself with, and then you can go back and you can keep doing that compassion or that emotional labor more effectively. Absolutely.
Wendy on Facebook wrote, I'm a service coordinator in senior housing. Most of my skills are soft skills, compassion and listening. It can be very emotional dealing with death and aging and family drama, but I love it and can't imagine doing anything else. So that Wendy would seem like a perfect candidate for the compassion fatigue and the toll of emotional labor, but she still loves her job.
Yeah, there's actually findings that workers who are highly identified with their career, which it sounds like Wendy is, don't see as much of the costs. And the idea there is that even if they are feeling tired, they override that for the sake of their job. They feel so strongly about what they're doing and what it means to their sense of self that they will withstand that effort and they will withstand that fatigue and keep doing it and keep doing well at it. But they're also a prime candidate for burnout unless they take those breaks and do good self-care.
Let's go next to Michael in Tomahawk. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to comment on, in other countries, say, for example, Poland, you really don't have in the service industry people smiling or it's very just professional and they just kind of do their job. And it's interesting because if you do smile at them, they get confused and they actually think it can be misinterpreted as flirting.
Right.
That's a great point. And I have to say, Alicia, I was tickled to find a scholarly paper about this topic that dealt specifically with French waiters.
Yes. So I used to do these talks on this topic, and everyone would always ask me this question, specifically because they'd had bad service encounters in France. So I went to France, and I did this study, and sure enough, it's not as problematic in France because they have more latitude to be able to kind of show how they actually feel.
Well, and actually the French here, when they visit here, they feel kind of bombarded by customer service and, you know, having a wait person come by every 2 minutes and say, how's that first bite tasting? Can I get you anything else?
Yeah, you know, they call us the Mickey Mouse culture.
Right.
The Disneyfication of service.
So it's a very cultural thing, the service with a smile, the customer's always right. That seems like a fairly American or at least North American idea.
Well, it probably originated here. It's the idea of differentiating one person's service from another. Hey, we don't only get you there on time, we do it with a smile. But it's actually become a worldwide phenomenon. So I've done a study where we looked at an Asian culture, a European culture. I'm trying to remember all of them. But we compared like four or five different countries, and we found that interactions with customers were expected to be similarly friendly across all of those, even though interactions with other parties, you know, coworkers or friends, those differed, the expectations differed. But that interaction with customer was expected to be similarly friendly everywhere we studied except for France. Now, we didn't look at Poland or Russia, which I believe is also similar to what you're describing, Michael.
Let's go back to the phones, and Matt in Madison is up. Hi, Matt.
Yes, hello. It is an interesting topic. I have an opportunity to observe a situation. I was training. I was brand new, and it was service industry. We were making deliveries of products. And anyway, the gentleman that was training me was a little bit of a curmudgeon. Anyway, when we arrived to make the delivery, the customer very pleasantly asked him how his day was going, and the gentleman that was training me gave a very candid response. He didn't sugarcoat it, and the customer became quite upset with that gentleman being so candid, and he went so far as to call our boss to complain.
Mm-hmm.
Complain about this gentleman. So it was an interesting experience that I observed, and it just relates to this topic, I think.
Great. Yeah. Thanks for that call, Matt. Alicia?
Yeah, there's a funny line that's been used. I can't remember who to attribute it to, but it talks about a service provider describing a customer coming up and saying, hey, where's my smile? And the employee saying, okay, you first. So he smiles, and then she says, now hold it for 8 hours.
Hmm.
And it's just that realization that, you know what, we all have bad days, we all have bad moments, and customers have to remember that, and they have to respect that, I think.
Thanks for that call, Matt, at 800-642-1234. And that's a really interesting point that you just made, Alicia, those kind of comments like, where's that smile? Or, you know, hey, you know, why aren't you looking happy to see me or something? Do you think that there's more of an expectation of women than of men in those roles to be that very, you know, bubbly, happy, I'm so glad to see you, even though I have no idea who you are kind of persona?
I think that we have gendered norms around that in general, but I think once you're in a service context, that trumps gender. you know, we expect the service provider to be friendly regardless of their gender.
But it could be an extra layer on that expectation.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking of all of these situations where we are expected to, you know, respond in a certain way, you know, Matt was saying that the person training him responded honestly, and it was clearly not what was expected or appreciated. As we have to do this in our everyday work lives, maybe for an entire career, what are some of the techniques or tactics that we can use to at least lessen how much it takes out of us?
Well, going back to that idea of deep acting, there is some evidence that if employees or managers can help their employees do perspective taking or practice mindfulness. I know it's one of these terms that's come up a lot, the idea of mindfulness, but anything that helps you reframe the situation and calm your body down so you're not as upset for that next interaction, so it doesn't continue to affect you person after person. You don't have to keep faking it all day. That deep acting technique can be more effective than using surface acting all day long. Other things that managers can do is to support and respect the effort that it takes. And that can take a financial form by recognizing employees that do a good job. I would say going beyond simply the Employee of the Month plaque, but having it actually be something that is valued and rewarded and recognized for the effort that it is. But also giving people some autonomy. We found that when workers feel like they have autonomy over their smile, over the way they handle their situations, they are less distressed, even if they do have to surface act occasionally. So it's respecting that sometimes it's just not the right time to fake that smile. That could be the customer is doing sexual harassment. It's not an appropriate time to fake a smile. Or it could be that that person just needs to have a break, and that should be permitted as well. And they need the autonomy to take that break to take care of themselves.
Are there any efforts in corporate America to actually train people who are in these kind of jobs to have some of those tools to make it a little easier on themselves? And in part, that would also acknowledge how hard it can be.
I think there's a variety of different corporate approaches that take a variety of different labels. So I know there's mindfulness interventions, for example. There's employee well-being interventions that can engage social support. It can encourage employees to talk to each other, to practice catharsis. So the earlier person that spoke about dealing with compassion fatigue, there's evidence that if employees can kind of talk to each other and kind of have a support group around their concerns, that can help move forward more effectively.
I have to say, back when I was waiting tables quite a bit for quite a number of years, one of the little techniques that I had when someone was just being, you know, kind of outrageously badly behaved as a customer was I would kind of turn it into an anthropological observation and just, mm-hmm. you know, kind of distance myself and think, wow, you know, in what universe would somebody think that's okay? And it just helped, like, to give myself that little distance. And I'll admit to feel slightly superior just to get me through, because often it was apparent the first time you walked up to a table that that was what the tone was going to be, and mm-hmm. you were going to be working with them for the next 45 minutes.
That's really interesting. I think that's similar to what doctors are taught to do in order to deal with surgeries that are difficult, right? Is they don't think about it as a person's body. They step back and think about the organs as they've been taught in medical school. So in a way, that's kind of what you're doing. You're distancing yourself from the emotions of it and thinking about it as, okay, this is just going to be a job because of the nature of this table or this customer.
I also would kind of use the kill them with kindness, like no matter how rude or, you know, unpleasant they were with me, I was that much more nice and sweet. And again, maybe this says something about me feeling a little superior by doing it.
Well, I think it can come off a little bit of sarcasm. You have to walk that line carefully, right?
I have a very sweet face.
You can get away with it then, maybe, more easily than other people. But I agree with that. That does help.
Well, Alicia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. It was great to be here, Judith. Thank you.
Alicia Grandy is a professor of industrial organizational psychology at Penn State University, and she was with us to talk about emotional labor and the impact it has on workers when they need to be nice. We've probably all heard the phrase, if only these walls could talk. Well, For one couple in California, that phrase recently became quite literal.
The couple was remodeling their bathroom when they found a surprise handwritten message written behind a wall. It included a picture of the couple that had lived there previously, some information about them, and among other things, the phrase, "If you're reading this, that means you're remodeling the bathroom again. What's wrong with the way we did it?"
Well, naturally, the couple shared the discovery on social media, prompting others to share the messages and items they found hiding in their own homes. Twitter users chimed in with their discoveries of antiques, beer cans, and let's just say hidden stashes of magazines. Well, Chris, have you had any experience with this?
You know, I'm a recent homeowner, so I haven't gone, you know, knocking down any walls yet. But I did find when we moved in, I was putting some stuff in the medicine cabinet, and I found a really old-looking bottle of, like, migraine pills.
Oh, dear.
And I'm thinking, like, of the previous homeowner sitting in his or her new place being like, oh, I got this really bad headache.
What did I do with those pills?
Yeah, exactly. So other than that, there haven't been any exciting finds. But until we remodel the bathroom, who knows?
There you go. Well, we did remodel the bathroom. We did not find anything. Now I'm really regretting not putting something under the floor. But, you know, I actually did just see on Property Brothers, one of the brothers had the kids in the family when they were remodeling a house do a little, like, time capsule and put it behind the fireplace.
Well, if you end up moving, definitely leave a message behind. And if you have something that you have found in your house behind a wall, hidden somewhere, let us know. Tweet us at Central Time WPR.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.